This is The Hard Move. Prepare for the worst with us this episode as Kyle and I befriend small ponies, speak elvish for friend, and trifle with an unreasonable amount of wizards as we pay the price.
If you wanted to live that JRPG fantasy,
I will assert and then immediately.
If you're a threat to the world, when people interact with you, there's going to be some consequences. And my second point, I do not remember.
My name is Sydney Icarus. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm an RPG designer and descriptivist. My guest for this fortnight is a games educator with a brain the size of a planet. His two major projects are General Intellect Unit, a podcast that is, much smarter than mine, and his involvement with Anticiplay, a games project imagining a sustainable future. He also took the time to design The Wind Began to Howl, which is a song-based small-table RPG that you probably have in your itch library from that giant bundle for racial justice we all bought this year. It is an intimidating pleasure to welcome my friend Kyle Thompson. G'day, Kyle. Please introduce us to who you are, including your wonderful voice and your pronouns.
Hello, I'm Kyle Thompson, and my pronouns are he, him. With games, I think I really got my start through the Gauntlet around about the same time that you joined the organization. Really at the start of the PBTA boom phase, I think would be when I got into TRPGs in a serious way. I had a little bit of experience of Fate prior to that, but PBTA was my true first love in TRPGs. Since going through that whole process with the Gauntlet and leaving and becoming my own TRPG person, people will probably know me best for my series Let's Learn Blades in the Dark on YouTube.
I love that series. That is, yeah, that is a wildly good series.
Thank you. So that was a bit of a educational experiment / free gift to the Blades community, where I turned Blades in the Dark, the whole Blades in the Dark text, into a series of PowerPoint slides and explained the entire game on YouTube. It was a pretty mammoth undertaking, and it's done tremendously well, and I still get lots of positive feedback from people in the comments on those videos saying how much it's helped them. So I'm really glad that I've been able to accomplish one major teaching goal in my life. Cause I have been a teacher, at many different levels of education. And, I've accomplished some goals, but I would have to say that video series was my biggest success.
I think, interestingly, you approach games from a very systemic perspective. When people look at Let's Learn Blades in the Dark, your way of talking about games is a lot less about, like, when you ask people about games and the first thing they do is like, okay, let me tell you about, like, my character?
Yes.
That is not your approach to games. And
that is true.
And it's fantastic because, like, Let's Learn Blades in the Dark is not you going down several rabbit holes of like let's talk about this cool time that thing happened in like example fiction. It's you very clearly breaking down like where those systems interact, and given that Blades is such like a heavy system game or like a heavy interacting economies game, I thought that was a really good showcase of like who and what you are. And I find that interesting because for two reasons. One is that will make your perspective in this conversation phenomenal, like phenomenally valuable.
I'm going to spoil something, which is that I brought Fellowship Second Edition to the show. I guess the viewers have already seen that on the episode listing, but it is quite a game, and I'm really looking forward to looking at it from this perspective.
Yeah, because Fellowship is, like, to segue cleanly, Fellowship is not a heavy system game, right? Fellowship is not about interlinking economies. There is one core economy of Fellowship, and that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. Can you, do you mind giving us, like, a quick rundown of what Fellowship is to you?
Yeah, I think, Fellowship is a game that's gone through two editions now. was one of the kind of, I'd say, like middle period PBTA games, the first edition. The author is also known for making the setting Inverse World for Dungeon World, and has integrated that in the second edition into Fellowship, which is really cool. It is a fantasy adventure game, which, as the name suggests, puts relationships front and center to gameplay. Like, that is the core of the game. This is very much the game where you defeat the big bad, and the power of friendship helps you along the way in a concrete mechanical sense. So if you wanted to live that JRPG fantasy in a tabletop form, I think it's really great in that way.
I find it interesting because, I'm gonna show my hand here happily. What excites me about this episode is that I don't like Pay the Price to Move. I don't, and like I've had episodes like this before. Pay the Price is my okay, Jacob, please, Jacob Randolph, author of Fellowship Second Edition. Please tell me you're not listening to this. Pay the Price is my least favorite version of my least favorite move, and I am here to interrogate that and find out like why. Because I. Wonderful. Have played Fellowship. I got to play it with Tyler, and it was a joy. It did exactly what it needed to do, and Pay the Price was not as bothersome as I thought it was going to be. So I'm here to find out like why the text and the play are so different.
It's so interesting, right? Shall we get into the text, what it says?
Yeah, we probably should. We probably should have a format to this show for sure. Would you like to read that for us, please?
All right, so the move is pay the price. When a move tells you to pay a price, tell us what it costs you. A price can be taking damage, losing or using equipment, suffering a setback, or losing an advantage. Whatever the cost, you must pay that price immediately before, during, or after the move you paid for. And that's it. That's the whole move.
So this is systematizing the like 7 to 9 of Act Under Fire for want of a better term. It is the way that I'm seeing this is the GM will give you a worse outcome, a hard bargain, or an ugly choice, and this game is saying that all comes under the concept of pay the price, and you get to decide what pay the price is. That could be using equipment in that ugly choice. Or it could be the like worst outcome or hard bargain in a fictional perspective. And I didn't do it. There's an episode on Act Under Fire in which Matthew speaks very kindly about it to his guests at the time. I would not have been so kind about it. It's my least favorite move. I guess what I want to start with is like. What is Pay the Price doing here that the 7 to 9 of Act Under Fire or Defy Danger is not doing?
I think what's going on here is that it's taking that element, which is under the heading of Act Under Fire or whatever, you know, variant in your standard PBTA game is. And it's making it something that interfaces with other moves. So to put it in maybe programming terms, it is a function that other moves can call at particular times. And I think the reason why it has been broken off from an Act Under Fire move is because responsibility is very diffuse in Fellowship. The GM-player relationship is not nearly as clear-cut as it is. One big thing about Fellowship that I think I neglected to mention is that the Overlord does not only play the GM role, they also directly embody a character who is the Overlord with a, like, 5-page playbook. You know, it is so intense, you know, being you. So you're playing a character who is the evil scheming overlord, and you are also doing a lot of GM stuff at the same time. And that means that the relationship between the player and, you know, the Apocalypse World MC becomes transformed into something that's much more complex. And so having something that moves can call, players can call, the GM can call, anyone can call, without that defined player-MC relationship that you see in Act Under Fire is maybe necessary for facilitating play. It's true that this game doesn't traffic in a lot of different economies. There aren't that many. Actually, when you look at, say, you compare it to like Dungeon World, like the character economies you're dealing with are quite simplified. But I think where the complexity comes in is in move interfaces. It's like moves calling moves is where the complexity is, or the number of playbooks and the number of moves that they have is where the complexity is, more so than I spend this thing to get that thing, and then it allows me to do action XYZ. Go ahead.
I'm interested to hear, like, specifically the moves that call this. So, like, importantly, this is one of those moves that everyone will interact with differently by virtue of not only, like, the fiction, but also the character. So, not just in what paying the price is, but on how you call pay the price. Do you want to talk a little bit about, like, Overcome and the basic move that leads into this?
Right. So as far as basic moves go, the move Overcome if you get a 7-9 on Overcome, which is you attempt to avoid, redirect, or prevent the harm something will cause, you can pay a price. So call this move, pay the price. You can call that move to take a 10-plus result. So you get a 10-plus result, you do the thing. Additionally, you have to pay a price, which you, the player, decide on. Or create a temporary solution. So a temporary solution will delay the threat, but when time is up, it'll be back in force. The Overlord will tell you when. So essentially, what it's doing is saying, first, the player has priority to do what they intended and declare a consequence for their character. And secondly, if they decide to come up with a temporary solution, the Overlord will come up with a consequence for Overcome. So it's setting an order of operations for who is taking control of the fiction. And the player has that option to take control if they want it, or pass it along to the GM as a kind of deferral, or to the Overlord as a kind of deferral.
I agree entirely that the game shows that greater degree of ambiguity because it wants players to develop those line-crossing competencies where they... I don't know if this was the first, but this is certainly the earliest PBTA game that I know that has a player agenda. That specifically on the playbooks calls out that the player has jobs to do.
Yes.
Including be brave, take risks. So including, like, you know, set high stakes, engage with the price. I agree entirely about the ambiguity and what it's trying to develop. And then there are versions of this move. There are rules that pay the price then calls on, which are hyper-specific in a way that I don't know why. Like, so the example I love is that the orc core moves are you can turn anything into a weapon, and then whenever you need to pay the price, you can always choose to break your weapon.
Yep.
And there is an interesting implication in that, why is that true? When you must pay a price, you may always choose to break your weapon. Why does that need to be stated for the orc? Isn't that true for everyone? Like, doesn't it literally say using and losing equipment?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, like, in a game of ambiguities, what do those hyper-specific, what would you call them? Like, in our object-oriented metaphor for programming mm-hmm. rules, what would you call those variables that then become like specific?
I think they would be, you know, it's giving you a priority in the choices you make with pay the price, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, big flag, you might want to sacrifice your orc weapon because you have this move. That's probably what you want to do. But, you know, if you're thinking something else, you could always just go to your standard pay the price. It's like a sequencing thing, right? It's very interesting because it's essentially giving you permission to do something you can already do.
Mm.
Right? As the player, you absolutely have that right to do it in any circumstance. It's giving you, like, legitimacy at the table, right? Like, oh, but I have Dishonor Before Death. Okay. Like, I don't need to justify this to you.
Cool. Right? So this is where we're unfolding into some interesting thing, because legitimacy is a great word to bring up here. So, like, what does, as a player who is trying to develop that legitimacy,
mm-hmm.
what does that look like? Because I think it comes up a lot in conversations about GM moves, where people are like, oh, we revert back to dealing damage too easily. Mm-hmm. We revert back to, like, take 2 HP because it is an easy deferred consequence and harm is a thing. As a player, where do we balance that as a player, how do we make the decisions about picking the most legitimate thing, but also the interesting thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's a very different consideration than when you're on the GM side of the question, right? It's like it combines your stakes in the character, right? Just their well-being as you identify with them. It combines your understanding of where the fiction is at the moment. And it combines, I think, like a sense of even, you know, mechanical calculation about what you're going to do in the future, and then even your sense of responsibility to the table, right? To play, to be a fan of the game, you might say, as opposed to being a fan of the players. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So I think from a design perspective, I kind of want to talk about some of the more interesting moves that mm-hmm. call on pay the price, because this is the thing that gets really cool. Overcome, I will assert and then immediately walk back. Overcome is a boring move, which I have had a significant amount of fun with. It, as I said before, textually, pay the price does not excite me, but for some reason, I've always had fun whenever it comes into play. Mm. I want to kind of explore some of the really interesting playbook moves that call on pay the price. One of the joys of having this object-oriented design is that other moves can then call on it in really interesting ways. Mm-hmm. This, doing the Murderous Ghost episode last week has changed how I think about these games. This is so good. So,
nice.
Do you have like a favorite of these playbook moves that you'd like to talk about?
Oh boy, I think a lot of them are interesting.
So this is where I start to turn around on pay the price, and I hope that this is like right at the 25-minute mark, and I get to put in the mid roll right here because that's a hell of a cliffhanger. The Hard Move continues to be supported by patreon.com/thehardmove, and especially by Blake, Kate, and my dad. Our Patreon ep this fortnight is Kyle and I discussing scale and threats to the world, the pre-negotiation of PBTA moves, and something that I've labelled as, I don't remember what this is, but it's probably too in-depth for the release cut. There's a post-it note next to my monitor, which is reminding me that I still need to pay Kyle, which I can only pay our guests because of the support that you offer me. Thank you for your part in that. I also want to bring your attention to Kyle's piece on viable organizing. It never really came up in our discussion, but I think it's worth a read. As a systems thinker, Kyle is an excellent person to read on building communities in times of great change. There's a link to the piece in the show notes, and I recommend giving it a look.
Fellow fans of The Hard Move, this is Sean Fager. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that a fair number of you enjoy seeing how the particulars of a game's mechanics affect the moment-to-moment play, for better or worse. And if that's true, you should take a look at the actual play reports and the consulting insights on Ron Edwards' site, adeptplay.com. There's even information there about hiring Mr. Edwards himself in the consultancy position if you're working on your own role-playing game. Again, that's adeptplay.com.
So this is where I turn around and pay the price, because there is something beautiful about the elegance of the design in being able to say, choose two, or pick your own cost and take three. There are four options here. So it is still a success with cost no matter what happens. Plus, there is the cost of paying the price. So, like, on a 7-9, at worst, you're getting two of the four. At best, you're getting three and paying a price of your choice, which provides a really interesting space. And this move would, like, there is a reason I'm not reading the text of this move out, because it is already textually dense enough without saying, choose to take damage, use or lose equipment, et cetera, like basically restating the text of pay the price in order to take three. There'd be a version of this at the end that says, you are in some way hindered or damaged or lose equipment. And none of that is interesting. None of that is as beautifully elegant and interesting as having four words or pay a price that everyone kind of knows what is going on.
Yeah, I mean, in functional programming, they usually refer to this as separation of concerns.
You are definitely going to have to unpack that for me.
Just that a function should have a clear purpose, and it should fulfill that purpose. It should take inputs, and it provide a clear output. By having pay the price be split off into its own move, it means you can just call pay the price. You don't need to restate and overcomplicate the night move, the call for help. It's just, you just pay the price, and then you go look at what does pay the price do? Oh, this is what it does. Or I already know what it does. It's a shorthand. So pay the price does pay the price, call for help does call for help, and they're not mixed up with each other. Because that's where you get, like, typographical errors, or it becomes too bloated, or, you know, the things you were mentioning, right?
Yeah. And I think also beyond the accessibility and the functional typographical part of it, I think there is also an element to this where by calling on pay the price, there is a known stake across the table that, like, most of the moves are going to be around, like, Fellowship mostly lives in the space where the 7-9 is paying the price, or you can pay the price to do a thing that is usually outside of other people's goals. The example of that is, you know, the wizard equivalent has You Shall Not Pass, where you can pay a price to stop someone from passing you. My next question is about where this fits into the core fantasy that Fellowship is trying to deliver. Fellowship is like Fellowship is Lord of the Rings, right? It's there in the title. It's a whole thing. Yeah. It's more than that, but it is the core fantasy that it's trying to deliver on is Sam and Frodo traveling to Mount Doom, and like that moment in Fellowship of the Ring where you have one of each of the peoples of the world pledging their sword and their spear and their axe, bow and axe, and then it not really being about it's not really about like do we beat the orcs or not. It's about like I can't carry the ring, Mr. Frodo, but I can carry you. It is about those moments of relationships. And so my big question about pay the price is, where does a move about, I just want to find the text. Where does a move about taking damage, losing or using equipment, suffering a setback or losing advantage fit into a story about best friends? Where does a move about taking damage, losing or using equipment, suffering a setback or losing an advantage fit into a game where the real treasure was the friends we made along the way?
Well, and I think this is another dimension of the game that is just as interesting, right? Because pay the price in this sense becomes a kind of token that you pass around the table, right? because you have these bonds that bind us move, right? You have the bonds that bind us move. When one player who shares a bond must pay a price, another may choose to pay that price instead. So you can interrupt the move and say, I'm going to take that price and I'm going to decide what it is and I'm going to pay it. And when you combine that with what the Overlord does, whenever you take direct action against the Overlord, you must pay a price to do so. Like anything you do. It's like in the intro of Blades of the Dark where John Harper says, like, you know, if this is a super, super duper amazing duelist and you want to attack them, then you're going to need to make a roll just to avoid getting taken out right away. You know, the Overlord is so powerful that they can do this, which then becomes a prompt for people to say, oh, but I will help you. Right. Like, it, you know how the defend move doesn't really work in Dungeon World. Right. And and this is like the whole interaction, these big dramatic confrontations that happen between the forces of evil and the Fellowship allow the players to demonstrate their bond with one another by taking that pay the price token for themselves or passing it around. You know, it has this whole other dimension to it that goes beyond the specific playbook move calling of pay the price.
That's really interesting. And that's I don't remember if this is just a Squire thing or if this is a whole thing. You can mark bonds with people like you can mark equipment, right? Like, you can... Is that a thing?
If you forge a bond with someone outside the Fellowship, they will join your cause as a companion so long as the bond holds.
Companion. So yes, you can... Companion is where I'm thinking of this, because that's... Yes, the Squire is becoming companion. So, you can mark, like, companions in the same way that you can mark equipment, which is lovely. Yes. So when you're the knight and you've called up those people and you go into battle with the army of Ghost Gondor behind you and you are forced to pay the price, that can be damaging that relationship or damaging, like, them as people as fairly as it can be running out of ammo for your bow.
Right.
Which is lovely. And, like, I think that maybe where I get tripped up, and I'm not sure if it's my core fantasy thinking or if it's the way that the game is laid out or if it's the way that the move is written, there is a part of me that always takes pay the price to those first things, you know, taking damage, losing or using equipment. Whereas the more interesting stuff about pay the price, the stuff that this game actually wants you to do is like altering your bonds with people and damaging your stats so that you roll with despair, which means that you want help from other people. This game kind of doesn't care about whether or not you have a sword.
The equipment and all that kind of stuff is sort of there to provide idea hooks, story hooks for what could be sacrificed, right? But at the same time, the Overlord is so powerful. Like, their ability to just deal consequences is so intense that you do end up depleting resources as a Fellowship when you run into them. Because they're literally, like, you know, in many games you have, like, a scale, right? There's a question of scale, like an order of might in Torchbearer, or tier in Blades. In this game, there are only two tiers, right? There is, you are not a threat to the world, or you are a threat to the world. So if you're a threat to the world, when people interact with you, there's going to be some consequences, and they're going to exhaust their resources. So it's almost like a way to both provide consequence ideas, but also just to, like, illustrate the power of the Overlord.
That's really interesting. I don't know if... Oh, I have feelings about that. I have feelings about that, Kyle. You have given me several feelings. I don't know if I like if that's better. Like, I don't know if, well, you're going to be depleting so many resources that some of them have to be less interesting is a good excuse for having a bunch of options be less interesting. And like, when I say less interesting, like, I know that there is a version of this where, like, you know, the elf's fine elven sword is very important to the character, and like, you know, they have a clear connection to it, and it is critical to what we have built up around the fiction of that character. But there is,
they have like a bond with the community that made it.
Yeah. But like, reflecting on that, as we've spoken about before, the orc literally has a move that lets them create things to pay the price with. Like, with but one move, you can create a weapon for yourself out of anything within arm's reach. Like, if you can break it, you can make a weapon out of it, and then you can destroy that weapon, and that's paying the price. And I get that that's a cool moment maybe once, but I'm not particularly interested in a version of this where it is the overlord making cuts, like making moves toward the players, and the orc player just being like, yeah, I pay the price to break my weapon, and then I do something else, and I pay the price to break my weapon, and then I make a new weapon, and I pay the price to break it. And like, it kind of gets into this sameness that I don't think, talking again about the genre that we're trying to replicate here, Lord of the Rings is about a very long, samey story being punctuated by moments of grandeur and difference. And pay the price sometimes feels like it's focusing on the wrong half of that sentence.
It's not hitting the grandeur and the difference.
And I think the reason for that is that it is trying to be something that can be called on at any point, and it's trusting the table. Like, for all the shit I'm giving them, like, and I don't know Jacob Randolph personally. I'm sure they're wonderful, and I would love to interact with them and chat about this. And I do like Philip. Like, I have a rule: I don't put games on this show that I hate. So like, it wouldn't be here if I didn't love it. I think that Jacob is putting a lot of trust in the tables to bring their own gravitas to pay the price.
Yeah, and I think it is very much that thing I said before about, as a player, being a fan of the game. This is part of your agenda as a player. If you want to play Fellowship, you got to bring it.
You've got to think dangerously.
It's a lot about context, and it's a lot, as you said, that trust in the player to do something interesting and not to just say, oh, I take one damage, or, oh, I'm going to, you know, be a quote-unquote, like, munchkin and just burn through items in the environment as an orc, because I can do that and I can game the situation that way. And it's very boring for everyone at the table, but I feel great because I broke the system.
So why... this is a great question. Why shouldn't pay the price be written to avoid that then? Like, go aggro is written to avoid that. Like, discern realities is written to avoid that. Turn someone on is written to avoid that. Like, why does pay the price, I say get away with, and I say it with love. Why does pay the price get away with giving the table the responsibility and being like, no, you make this interesting?
I think it's partially because the surrounding moves help to color it and provide interest.
Oh, that's good.
The rules context is very important in Fellowship. It has this kind of decentered flow to it where you kind of have to bring the disparate parts of it together in the way that they interact with each other in order to understand how it works. Because it's not very upfront about what it does. Because, you know, we've had this conversation is like, oh, and another thing, and another thing, and another thing that pay the price does. And my second point, I do not remember. But that was a good point. Well, the second point, I think, is just like, you know, I've played Dream Askew and the many games that were designed after it. And they put an enormous amount of responsibility on the players, like even more than Fellowship. I don't think that means it's like I'm out. Like I don't want to play this game. It's really a different kind of game for a more like collaborative and therefore shared responsibility storytelling experience.
Yeah, right. That framework is really interesting. This is where pay a price really doesn't seem in text to be a strong enough move to fit here. Like, does does Frodo really pay a price when the Ringwraiths come near, or the Eye of Sauron like locks upon him? I would suggest that the text of pay the price is probably a little bit light for what we see on screen in there. I think actually talking about hard cuts and like cuts as hard as you like to use Apocalypse World terminology is showing me something that I wish Pay the Price had that it doesn't, which right. is that hard word, right? We have made a clear distinction between soft cuts and hard cuts, between soft GM moves and hard GM moves. We have made a different distinction between showing signs of an approaching threat and dealing damage or taking away their stuff. We have made that decision to give them time to respond because we understand that the tempo of the game requires different things. There is no soft pay the price and hard pay the price. Well, technically there is, but it is decided by the player at the table at the time. And
it's the game is essentially saying there is a degree of consequence and a format for consequence that is ordinary. And then there is the degree of consequence when you meet the Overlord in person, right? That degree of consequence is the one where you're not going to pay the price. It's just like in your standard PBTA game where the MC is going to decide something and that's the price.
Mm-hmm. Like, there is a... I hate doing three-year crafting on this show because it's not the intent, but, like, there is a version of this move where there is the bronze price and the gold price, and the bronze prices that you can pay is, like, use up equipment, and the gold price is, like, put yourself in mortal danger and stuff like that.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
And like, I just...
opening it up even more to the player in terms of how hard they want to push against their own character.
Yeah, because I just come back to the whole time of like, and I come back to it because it is the one that exists in text, which is to take direct action against the Overlord. My orc breaks their weapon, and then when the Overlord rocks up and I have to relive my pain, I break my weapon. And like, it is the only one in text. There is no other version. The halfling doesn't get a version of pay the price that says you can always make someone feel bad about themselves to pay the price or anything like that. And in fact, a lot of people have moves that are like, when you do a specific thing, you don't have to pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is like where I'm falling at. The one version they've given me in text is so uninspiring when I look at these beautiful moves of grandeur.
Yeah, I agree. It's because it's so generic, in its use, it doesn't have a lot of, you know, color or pop to it.
Mm.
It's very procedural. It's just like, okay, this is what happens. And it's not even written with like flowery language to make it scary.
No, it's not.
It's not just this is what happens, right?
It's just like when you are asked to do this, just tick a box. Like, yeah, that's the thing. It's not even written fictionally, right? It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not
because the fictional context is all in what's calling pay the price.
Yes,
it's not in pay the price. It's an addendum to other moves. So yeah, it's. I think you might get a better result by having a more complex system for consequences. That being said, the game is already tremendously complex. And there's a lot going on in this game. So I can kind of understand shooting for like the barest simplicity in describing this thing. But I completely agree with you that the move itself, that's why I said when I first introduced it, I was like, and that's it. That's all there is. Like, it's just okay. Like, a little dry.
Yeah, like it is, but it is also so exciting. Like, this is a design space that I love.
Yeah.
Like, I love the idea of there being six moves and then having 30 other moves, but they all just call those six in different ways. Like, that is super exciting to me.
It's very cool. And it's a thing that you don't see very much in PBTA games. So I think I wanted to highlight that.
So
as like, this is a cool thing that this game does.
I think I disagree that you don't see a lot in PBTA games, because I think what you've convinced me is this is the equivalent of GM moves, which we see all the time, right? Like,
sure.
This and so we do see this a lot. We just don't see it on the same. It's not like on a 6-, the GM will take away your stuff, put you in danger, show signs of an impending threat, etc. Or the MC will do that. It just says on a 6-, like prepare for the worst. This is the player facing version of prepare for the worst.
Yes.
Except it is not prepare for the worst. It's prepare for the mediocre. It's prepare for the moderate.
Yeah, prepare for the thing that is going to be somewhat bad.
The Hard Move was created by Matthew Gravelin and is hosted and produced by me, Sydney Akris. Follow the show on Twitter @TheHardMove and find bonus content, including full-length episodes, at patreon.com/TheHardMove. Music is by Nick Gravelin. Thank you, Nick. You can find his work at nickgravelin.com. You can follow Kyle @WeGraf. That's WIEGRAF and then an underscore. And check your itch for The Wind Began to Howl. Content featured in this episode is from Fellowship 2nd Edition by Jacob Randolph, published by Liberi Gothica Games. Mark Experience.